Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy. Once again, we are talking about how recruiting works, this time with Jeff Tambroni, Penn State Nittany Lion head coach. Coach Tambroni, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
So just for reference, we're recording this on September 11th, a day that matters a lot in the history of this nation. And also, I know in terms of your relationship with the Cornell program, and I'm sure a lot of other programs that you've been involved with. So just want to start by acknowledging that and paying homage to those who sacrificed and lost their lives that day.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek.
This is going to run over the course of the next couple of days, and with respect to how recruiting works, the most substantial factor there is you've begun to talk to members of the class of 27. For listeners that haven't tuned in previously, you're not allowed to talk about players in the class of 27 by name. You're also not even allowed to talk about your 26s until after they sign the NLI. So we're just here to talk about in generalities, basically your process and how you go about it. And we always like to start with the same first two questions. I'm going to tweak the first one a little bit because it's gotten a little bit repetitive. But basically, the phrase that coaches use when they talk about how important recruiting is to their program is that it's the lifeblood. There are a couple guys whose opinions have deviated a little bit, but I do think that it's useful to start just with a binary, the yes-no. Do you describe recruiting as the lifeblood of your program?
Yes.
Very good. How do you enjoy it? How important is it?
I enjoy. I mean, I say this all the time, like our profession, you can just chop it up throughout the course of the year. I don't think I would enjoy any of it if it was 12 months of the year because it's so intense. It's so concentrated. The recruiting piece, the evaluation piece, the season itself, the off season. But I enjoy getting out and watching the next generation and recognize how important it is in so many ways. I mean, I love what I do. Our staff loves what they do. And in some way, shape, or form, you have a chance to choose who you do it with. So my motivation to come into work every day kind of drives that motivation to, you know, evaluate and recruit and try to bring the young men and families who we think just fit that model to a degree that's going to, you know, inspire us and motivate us to be here and do what we do on a day-to-day basis.
How do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
I think I've learned, you know, over the course of the years. I mean, I've been doing it as a head coach for 25 years right now, and we've definitely evolved quite a bit. And I think talent certainly won out in my early years of recruiting, and I think that we've changed quite a bit in terms of some of the intangibles that I know get along with either me or our philosophy or our overall mission. So we try to connect our evaluations, both tangible and intangible, as much as we possibly can. I'm also very self-aware that we've made, you know, plenty of mistakes in our career in terms of just where young men will go or how they'll fit. And, you know, that's never a good thing for either side. It's not for the families, not for the young men, not for the program. But I think that the single most important factor is fit. So we've tried to do as good a job as we can of not just evaluating talent, but how that young man, based on he reacts and interacts, is going to fit within our program and with us as a staff.
I'm so glad you answered that way, because the nature of how I try to structure these conversations in order to avoid them being repetitive is by isolating a particular element of what I know or understand about how you, your staff, your program goes about it. And when it comes to not just your Penn State tenure, but also your Cornell tenure, what I really want to structure this conversation around is building culture through recruiting. And so let's go all the way back to when you took the Big Red over, I believe, was it 2001 or 2002?
2001 was our first season, yeah.
And so, you know, that was an interesting point because, and I'm just going to lay out my impression of this, and I'd like you to kind of correct it where I'm wrong. Okay. So Cornell, legendary teams in the 70s, but they definitely had a reputation for going to Grateful Dead shows, among other things. And so I think that, you know, there was this very strong notion of, you know, they were you know, the fun bunch and the guys for whom, you know, they, it's not to say that they didn't take lacrosse seriously, but it is to say, you know, that it was a part of their overall lifestyle. And as, you know, the program, you know, just whether it was stopped to have the success that it did or some competitors in league started to have a tremendous amount of success at the end of Richie Moran's era, Dan Petromella takes over. And I would imagine, as is the case in a lot of those types of, I don't know if rebuild is too strong of a word, but certainly reset, you know, establishing a culture that is a better fit for the current era, as well as the current era in terms of the era of competition, but also the current era in terms of the types of athletes that you're going to bring into your program and find success with. You know, it's just, it's a very natural thing that happens. How do you describe, you're obviously an assistant on Dave's staff, what it was like to be a part of that first cultural reset, and then how you continued to extend it once you took over. And the reason that I want to isolate Cornell before getting into Penn State is because that program has become synonymous with culture over the last 25 years. And I know that you were instrumental in doing that.
You know, I give Coach Petromella a lot of credit. Like he was blessed that he brought me up there and taught me so much about what it meant to be in the profession of coaching. And, you know, that first year, first 6 months for sure, like I lived with him. Like we literally, we would get up, leave his house about 6 o'clock in the morning. We would come home just about every night at about 10:30. And then we would grab something to eat on the way home or at his house and then reset the next day. It was an insane.
The health of those meals is pretty legendary.
A lot of McDonald's. It was, yeah, it was never great. But I learned so much about everything in the profession and super grateful. Spent 3 years with him, changed over. And from everything that I learned from my high school coach, Mike Messer, from my college coaches, Dave Urich in particular, Dave Petromella, like, man, I could have written a book about every detail about what it really meant to be a coach, to build a culture. And I kind of shifted in a different way and turned it to winning versus building. And you know, fast forward to 2004 when George passed away. I tell this story quite a bit because it's so meaningful for my life. That's the most tragic, most challenging day that I've ever had to face. But it was the crossroad of where I started to shift and try to change the mindset of what it meant to be a coach, what it meant to be around a team. I watched that group organically develop into what I would consider the greatest team I've ever been a part of because of the way they responded, how they supported each other. And that quote-unquote culture, it ran organic in the next 6 years of that tenure. So through the course of 2004 through 2010, meaning that I never felt I was leading the charge in setting this foundation of this is how you create culture. These are the things that we're going to do. So it was unintentional, but it was just, it was love. It was compassion at its greatest sense. And we all had one purpose. It was just like the spirit of George Boyardi ran through every one of us. And we vowed on that day, March 17th, that we were going to carry that forward. So without knowing it, probably just absorbed it. And I think everyone that was there just continued to pass it on to the next generation. So it became real. When I got to Penn State, certainly took all of that and what we learned. And I do think that we have tried to become much more intentional on creating, on fostering, on building, on sustaining quote-unquote culture from what we learned. So it certainly ironic. We never really talked about it. And I felt like, man, the culture was so strong. The brotherhood was so strong. Here, we've spent a lot more time trying to create it with much more intent.
So that's a really nice natural segue into talking about one of the, what I would assume is the primary challenge or a primary challenge of being the head coach at Penn State, which is straddling the line between having all of the very appealing offerings of a you know, largest state school with an incredible game day football experience, and not just football because the wrestling and volleyball games are incredible as well. The hockey games are really cool too. While also so finding the balance where you're giving enough opportunity to enjoy that aspect of the experience, because it's why you go there, relative to a lot of the other places that your players might go, while also maintaining the seriousness and sincerity and culture around what you're trying to accomplish as a team. How do you describe how that challenge evolved from, call it 2011, through whenever it felt like you had your arms around that challenge?
Phenomenal question. And I think about it, talk about it. We communicate this with our recruits all the time. So when I first got here, we didn't want this to be surrounding the football culture. We wanted it to be Penn State lacrosse. We tried to center the pendulum about, like, not balance as in, like, hey, you get equal parts social, academic, and athletic. It's like, look, if you want to be exceptional at being a student athlete, well, then you're going to have to sacrifice a little bit of what's going on, even though there are options and choices here at Penn State, like every single day at such a significant level. So we pushed all the way back to the other side. Like, we would practice on Sunday mornings after football games to make sure that, hey, look, that just wasn't going to happen. And I still talk to the guys that were here back in our early years. I mean, we definitely pounded it pretty hard and drove it really hard and centered on Penn State lacrosse. I think over time, we have been able to, thanks to that group and those first two or three groups and what they were willing to suffer and sacrifice to get there. And I think our pendulum is much more balanced now because of them. And we talk about this all the time in recruiting. I'll talk to every recruit that comes up there with their family. Like, mental health has been a big piece, and it's helped us change the narrative here, like, especially after COVID. Mental health is a, you know, challenging issue everywhere, and I do think it's really important. I've come to realize it with my three daughters that we have. They're either in college right now or recently graduated. That is an important phase of college as well, to be able to unplug, get away, go have fun, whether it's socially downtown, go watch a football game, go watch a hockey game, go to a concert here on campus. So whereas in the beginning we had it all and I probably shied away because I just wanted to focus so much on building our culture, now it's a great balance and enhancement for us and families and kids. You have to recruit discipline and passionate young men who are driven to succeed and become exceptional student athletes. But at the same time, it is really unique at this institution because it happens at such a, you know, a significant level. So it's a great question, and I think it's evolved over time, some of it naturally, some of it because of the response through COVID. And, you know, I think we're very fortunate to have it here and no longer suppress it. Our guys are doing a really good job of just holding each other accountable and making sure that it's a part of it without getting in the way of our goals or overall mission.
Yeah, so I think the player-led accountability piece that you brought up is what I want to come back to. But, and I certainly don't, I hope you don't think that I'm harping on this. I think it's really important. I just have two follow-ups. So the first is that it seems justifiable to me that it was reasonable to go hard, to swing the pendulum hard one way for the first couple years. I don't want to make assumptions about what the culture was like prior to your arrival, but because it and this is again why I kind of wanted to frame it around your Cornell experience as well. Like, states of the program were relatively similar in terms of the way that the things were transforming around them, right? Competitively, you know, and when you arrived, you didn't know that big time lacrosse was coming, but, like, you know, the ECAC was getting more competitive and, you know, getting wins against Loyola and Denver was not, you know, whatever. So point being that, like, there were, you know, the wins and losses hadn't come. And I'm sure that, you know, had manifestations in terms of some of the off-field choices that the team was making. So I guess it's not really a question, it's more of an observation. And I'll let you speak to that in a second. But then the second side is, and this is a question, you kind of brought it up from the mental health side in a post-COVID world, but every study or survey that's coming across, you know, my purview now is about how this generation of kids are drinking and partying less. And so while there are the experiences that you talked about with respect to Penn State are not solely centered around that, has the ability to maintain a healthier culture come back to you because some of the native choices that the kids are making who want to be a part of your program?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I have the answer to it, but I would just say in both sides, as I reflect back, I do think purpose plays such a big part in that. And, you know, if you're losing games, you tend to shift and find less reason to invest at a level that maybe just doesn't make sense to the same degree when you're winning. And I think when we first got here, it would be unfair to talk both prior to my arrival at Cornell when I was there with Dave Petromala, prior to our arrival here at Penn State. But I do know that it's hard. Like, it is hard. You put a lot of time and effort into it, and when you're not getting the results on the weekend and you lack purpose, you tend to turn away from the investment of earlier morning workouts, staying a little bit late. At Cornell, I think the purpose was clear, right? So no matter if we won or lost, or it was cold or it was hot or it was early or it was late, it always seemed to go back to it. And it was just almost a responsibility and a blessing to be a part of it because of the spirit that we were representing. Here at Penn State, it did take a little while to create a sense of purpose around what we were doing. So I think part of that was it was challenging because we were still, you know, not winning at that degree. And I do think there's just a lot more purpose in what we're doing. To the point about, you know, the trend of where kids are right now, I do think the expectations are just much higher. Their aspirations are much higher. It's not to say that when I was in school or you were in school, we didn't want to win. We did. But my gosh, we're putting so much more time into nutrition and sleep and the way hydration and, I mean, everything. And I think they're just a little bit more in tuned to some of the benefits or detriments of some of the things that they're doing, to their credit and to the resources that are available to teach and enhance. So I don't know the answer, but I do think, you know, they're motivated student athletes at this age, and they're exceptional in their ability to do things, all things that go into becoming high-level students, high-level athletes, much more so than I was when I was their age, and, you know, even 15, 20 years ago, for sure.
No, I think that's really well said. You know, there are a couple of high-level pro lacrosse players who, you know, I have memories of in that, call it, you know, 2011, 12, 13 range when, you know, we'd be somewhere social and, you know, they'd be drinking water and they'd just be like, you know, if you knew how hard I worked out today and how much six Bud Lights would ruin what I did, then you would be drinking water too. Which is one of the reasons I'm not a pro lacrosse player. There's a million, but that's definitely one of them. All right, shifting gears. One of the things that I think is so interesting about Penn State is the relative relationship that Penn State has to Pennsylvania, to its state, and particularly the relationship between the development of lacrosse in Southeast Pennsylvania and more broadly, you know, Central and Western Pennsylvania as well, but certainly in the Philadelphia area. And I guess I'll put it this way. You know, I don't know that, let me put it this way. When you think about some of the transformative players in the program over the course of your tenure, you think about Grant Ament, Jack Ament Trainer, TJ Malone. They're all Pennsylvania guys, right? I don't know if they all grew up being Penn State fans, but certainly I know that they are now. And what I'm interested in is how you have regarded the relationship between your school and your state or your school and Philadelphia, again, on a relative basis to, you know, Syracuse bills itself as Central New York's professional team. University of Maryland has, you know, a claim over the state of Maryland in a way that, you know, whether it be the presence of Pitt or, you know, any other kind of factor, I don't know that Penn State outwardly is viewed the same way, whereas inwardly it would suggest that the results suggest that it is, that relationship between your state and your school is as strong or stronger. How do you think about it?
You know, I think it has evolved over time. So when I first got here, our relationships with Pennsylvania lacrosse were, I would say, okay. You know, at Cornell, we had very few Pennsylvanians on that team. A lot of our guys, Long Island guys, upstate New York guys, some New England, Pennsylvania, we did not have a lot. So I didn't have great relationships or ties down there. And we didn't recruit it as hard. And I learned over time. I mean, there is just an essence of growing up surrounded by Penn State fans and the loyalty and passion of Penn State that just changes a young man's purpose when he gets here. And, you know, we've gotten to the spot now where we've really tried to dig in and try to recruit as many Pennsylvanians as we can, the best of the best. Coach Franklin in football, I think, does a really good job of it. And we, I learned, like, one time he's gotten on a Zoom call with one of our recruits who happened to be a Pennsylvania recruit, and he talked to him, and I just sat back on the Zoom call and listened, and he was fabulous, just talking about the connection of why this institution was even built in the first place for residents of Pennsylvania. And it inspired me to continue the process that we had just started to evolve into in recruiting more of them. I do think, you know, because of their background, because of the loyalty and passion of, you know, so many Penn Staters that they've grown up with, they've seen it on TV, especially with the football team. They just have such a sense of pride when they come here. It's different, but it has been really hard. I mean, we're 3 hours away from the hotbed of Philadelphia, and other programs are closer than we are there. So we have tried to maintain a stronghold on, you know, that area, because it's just such a natural connection, and that loyalty piece, the passion piece of coming to an institution representing your home state like they do through the course of the summer when they play in some of these events. I mean, it is a loyal and very proud both fan base and student athlete population that the benefits of, you know, even if it's like 50-50, I think he's pretty good, and it's 50-50, you go with a Pennsylvanian who has a background and a knowledge about what it means to be a part of Penn State, has a little bit of the history, the purpose grows so significantly that you just gain so much value. So we have tried as hard as we can, but there's a lot of schools right now scooping into Pennsylvania, making it more and more challenging.
It is a double-edged sword. As the quality of lacrosse increases, then the quality of player increases and the vultures start to circle.
Oh, yeah. They're here.
One thing that I'm curious about is how you position the academic offering that Penn State can provide. And this is going to sound like I'm defending Penn State, and there's a degree to which I am, but what I'm really doing is just kind of buttressing against the status quo assumptions. And let me do it by just kind of explaining, like, you know, Matt Brown and Bill Tierney aren't going to love hearing me say this, but Denver has a reputation for being not as academically rigorous or prestigious or as hard to get into as, you know, some of the other kind of upper tier lacrosse schools. I push back on that with the notion of, number one, if you want to work in the Mountain Time Zone, and number two, if you want to work in oil and gas, there's no better place for you to go that offers Division I men's lacrosse. By a similar token, Bank of America hires more first-year analysts from Penn State than any other school. So, like, any notion that it's a limiting opportunity, I push back against. And again, I'm not trying to do your job for you. What I'm trying to say is, like, on the one hand, because you're an enormous institution, you probably have an opportunity on the front end with some students that might not be able to get admitted to some other, you know, high-end academic institutions. But on the other end, you have an opportunity to be able to say, we offer the things that you can get from this experience are really significant. How do you try to tell that message?
First of all, I could not agree with you anymore, and I appreciate you even bringing this up and talking about this. And so we understand exactly who we are, and there's reputation, and we think there's in part reputation with substance. And I do think, because of the network at Penn State, we lean on it heavily. So there is both parts. We know who we are. There's diversity in the offerings. Like, you can study pretty much anything you want, and if you find something that you love, you'll tend to do it harder, longer, and more successful over time. So here, I think we can offer just so much to our student athletes to establish that foundation of what it means to be here, to get an education, but to do something that you love or that you're good at. And both of those things, you know, historically have found success. That's what successful people do. Either do something that you're good at, do something that you love, do it for a long time, and you'll find success. I think the substance that we communicate to recruits, to families, to everybody, is just, it's the alumni network, and I toot the horn of our alums. They are so involved. I mean, there's the big picture, 750,000 alums, global recognition, but our lacrosse alums have done a phenomenal job of just actively coming back, reaching back, and making sure that our guys are prepared. So to your degree, we have tried to just stay in our lane, recruit really hardworking young men who value the balance of our education. There is, you know, not just the diversity of what you can study, but there's a balance to learn how to be independent 3 or 4 years and to be prepared for life after college. That is, yes, school, yes, lacrosse, and yes, a social life that will help actually real life preparation. And we have now established in so many ways with our alumni network, we call it Teammates for Life, mentor programs that have really helped our guys transition through their collegiate years. Our own LinkedIn account for Penn State Lacrosse, which has given our guys an opportunity to actually, where the rubber hits the road, gain internships, get jobs. So we're doing it. It frustrates me to the same degree that you're talking about when you don't do a little research about where they are when they start, where are they when they graduate, what kind of jobs, what kind of internships do they have access to, and how successful they are when they get out. I think that's the metric that we would love more recruits, more families to look at, because I think if you look at the track record of where our guys have been, in particular over the last 5 to 7 years when this network and portal have really kicked into to high gear, our guys have been very successful finding jobs in a hard job market and sustaining jobs because of the network that they're surrounding. And if I look back and just say, look, you were prepared based on how hard you were willing to work, based on the connection that you had, the love that you had for your major or for the school, I think it all connects back to the success that they're having right now.
I visited 2 falls ago, and I asked Joe Bucci to give me more or less the tour. How many seats are in your golf cart? How many miles have you put on that golf cart over the course of the last?
Plenty. Yeah. 6 seats. Yeah, they still don't let me drive it, but 6 seats in there. Yeah.
How do you describe the visit?
Oh, you know, we have a recruit on campus right now, and part of our communication to them is this is an opportunity for you just to learn about who we are, what we are, why we do things the way we do it. What I don't want to do is become a salesman in our recruiting efforts, because I do think it's important for someone to choose us for who we are versus for us to talk someone into being here. I know how we go about our business. I know Jeff Tambroni's day to day. I'm not for everyone, but I think if you want to be here, if you're passionate about being here and you clearly understand not just what's here, but the expectations, well, then you're going to thrive no matter what happens, because you'll find purpose in what you're doing. In Penn State, over the last number of years, we'd love to have you come back up, because in the last 2 or 3 years in particular, Pat Kraft, our AD, has just exploded in terms of the resources that he has provided for our student athletes. And so the visit is an opportunity to see what's available. This is what you'll need to do. This is how we'll support you. And I think those opportunities either are going to connect with families or they are not. And I think both ways we need to be comfortable with who we are, what we can bring to certain families. And if this is something that they want to be a part of, then usually it works for both sides.
The way I structure this series of podcasts is I have one conversation with a coach in each conference each year, and this is year 3, which suggests that you're the only coach in the Big Ten that I'm going to be speaking to. Talked to Coach Janowski a couple weeks ago, which means that there are 2 conferences that are affected by the changes in college athletics more than the rest of college lacrosse. And candidly, the Big Ten and the SEC are on one side of the spectrum, and the ACC and the Big 12 are on the other side, which means that you're the only person that I'm going to talk to this year that can give us this moment in time insight into what a post-house settlement world looks like for the portion of college athletics that are going to be most significantly affected by it. So how's it changed?
So I would probably divide it into 2. So 1, significantly better. I think because of the resources here at Penn State, because of the position that we put ourselves in, we as in big picture, the athletic department, the business that is being run here, I mean, it is clearly a business. The success of our football program historically has allowed us to be in a position to create a ton of earnings for facilities, for staff, for players who are here, student athletes, both men and women. So I think in that regard, significant. I mean, we just built a $32 million facility for 800 athletes, student athletes, to dine with a medical facility underneath it, in large part because of it. So it's become a business in that regard, and I think we were positioned very well. I think if you look at it individually, like, each sport is going to be affected a little bit differently outside of football, and the athletic department can pick and choose how they want to either impact positively or possibly negatively. So I think it would be, if you brought all 31 coaches on here from Penn State, I think you'd run the gamut of, this has been unbelievably productive, unbelievably successful. The advancements that we've made in this are, you know, this is once in a lifetime, all the way down to, this has been really challenging. You know, we went from X amount of scholarships to maybe limited or none. So I think a lot of it just depends on the structure or tier of where you are in a specific school. I do agree with you. I think schools like Penn State within the Big Ten are positioned really well to just support its student athletes. But I think each school is going to be supported differently if you divide it down by sports, men and women. And I think it just depends on either where you fall within the athletic department, the success that you're having currently, the relationships that you have with your administration, on how either positive or negative that will be affected.
And are you pleased or satisfied with where you've currently situated?
Very much. Packraft has been very supportive of lacrosse. I mean, he did not come from it. You know, BC was just women. Temple, he did not have in his background, Indiana, but he has been really good. He's been here for 3 years, and I think in the last 3 years since he's been here, it's been exciting for him. We've been in the Final Four two of those 3 years, so he's been able to see it firsthand. So he's been very bullish on supporting both our men and women. Kayla Trainer came on board here just this past year. He is bullish on trying to get Penn State lacrosse, both men and women, into this championship weekend to hopefully someday hoist national championship trophy. So we're, I would say, in a very good position, and we're grateful because of it.
Shifting to the other side of the spectrum, how do you describe the conversations that you've been having with families? Parents, I would assume, are probably a little bit more either informed or uninformed, meaning, you know, they think they know what the reality is, and probably asking a little bit more direct questions. And again, I'm sure that it's a spanned gamut based on, you know, the 10 or 20 conversations that you've had so far. But just in terms of general characterization, do you find that the parent of a typical, you know, prospective student athlete has a reasonable set of expectations for what reality is, or an unreasonable set of expectations?
Great question. And I think that depends. Like, I think there's a lot of club coaches out there that really do a good job of just making sure that there is a level set of expectations prior to a visit. And, you know, what I do think is misunderstanding is like, oh, now lacrosse has 48 roster spots, there's unlimited scholarships, you can give up to 48 scholarships, which is true. You can give us up to 48 scholarships if that's the roster number that you have. There's no limit anywhere to an opt-in team, which we are. The reality is very few teams, if any in the country, are going to have enough financing to provide 48 full scholarships for their team. So I think understanding the way those things work, and that typically comes from either club coaches or high school coaches that have been around for a while, or when we start to communicate with families and start to invite them up, level set that conversation, make sure that you're out there in front of it so that you can gain, you know, a better appreciation about what you're getting yourself into. Because the last thing you want is to get to the end of a conversation and either not have an offer, or an offer that you don't think is sufficient or fair. And that's hard. And I think as long as you can level set those expectations prior to the visit, then it helps. But I would say the range is so wide to people who come up and are super appreciative that you're even talking about offering or any sort of finance to parents who believe if it's anything less than a full scholarship, then you're not interested in their son. And that becomes challenging, but typically it's workable through an education, through a conversation. So it runs every year from one end of the spectrum to the other.
So I want to end by talking a little bit about trends, because we've just been talking about trends for 5 or 10 minutes. And the biggest trend in the class of 26 relative to the class of 25 was how fast the group committed, how many kids committed within the first 3 to 4 weeks, and then how that continued on through the end of October and through the end of November as well. I don't have the number committed to memory. I do have it, but something like 30% more kids committed at the end of each month for the class of 26 rather than the class of 25. The initial, you know, like I said, we're 10 days in. Initial return is that the 27s are pacing at roughly the same pace as 26s. My sense is that And this is always, there's kind of a trickle down effect where, you know, kind of offers are being held or considered as players who have the leverage to take the visits that they want to take do or don't take those visits. And then what subsequently happens in terms of, you know, the offers that are made, and the way the priorities shift after certain players commit, you know, that is the market dynamic that, you know, changes year to year. I have one kind of general trend that I want to ask you about. But before I do that, what have you noticed about the first 10 days of communication and you know, what the quote unquote market has looked like with the class of 2027?
Well, I mean, I say this and I've said this to you before. You're one of the most innovative thinkers in our game. And I would love for you to come back and create a solution to that, because you're 100% dead on. Like within the first 2 weeks, within the last couple of years, certainly within 25 to a degree, 26 for sure, like you're saying, 27, within the first couple of weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks, and we track, you know, when we visit, did they say yes, did they say no, things of that nature for our own good as well. And within the first couple of weeks, it is significant the amount of young men that you'll have in your class at that point. By the third week of September, you're probably going to be done in recruiting, and it just seems a little unfair to create that kind of angst getting into September 1st, getting to that process, and then running through this. I am just as much a cause of this as anyone, so I don't blame the system. We create the system. The kids do, the club coaches do, parents do, the coaches do, we all do. So you are 100% accurate, and it's really challenging. You know, it's a puzzle. So if you love us, we love you, it's easy. So that's a category, but it's a really small category and small window. More often than not, there's like, well, that school's my first, and then we think, okay, you might be second or third, trying to figure out when that domino is going to fall to move you to first versus or in alignment to their first, and that's when it becomes really challenging. So week one, probably the least challenging. Everyone's interested because they're coming up in week one. You're super interested in having them in week one. Weeks two and three, that's where that juggling act comes a little bit, and it's hard on parents, on kids, on coaches, everyone alike. And we've talked about this as staff. Is there a process to just be able to go through for a longer period of time where decisions couldn't be made, and then provide a window of that? Now, yeah, so the trend, you're dead on, and it just continues to keep, the window continues to keep shortening and shortening. You know, people who are at the top of the list, top 10 recruits, they can hold on the longest because they're really holding the cards, and others have to kind of wait and figure out when that domino is going to fall to align the number one to number one so you can find an appropriate place.
I said that I noticed a little bit of a new trend, something that I think was a little bit deviated from last year, which was in the first week, I felt like we saw a larger number of commitments who, and you know, if you're one of these kids, this is not meant to be pejorative. You very well might end up being the best player in your class and you know, go on to become an All-American. But there, it seemed as though there were a significant number of players who made commitments, and the assumption was that they were what you would call back half of the class kids, meaning good enough players that coaches were like, yeah, we want you to be a part of our program, but not so sought after that each individual opportunity for the kid wasn't what he assumed was going to be the best available to him. And what's different from last year is that I don't know that the programs moved on those guys last year. And so as a result, while at the expense of focusing on the top end of the class, so to speak, and so it seemed as though it was a little bit more distributed across other programs, right? Specifically non-ACC, Big Ten, and Ivy League programs. Did you notice that at all? Do you feel like there's any merit to that? Do you feel like your peers maybe emphasized being a little bit more holistic in terms of, yeah, we know who our, you know, 3 to 5 most highly sought after targets are, but we also know that if this guy ends up being, you know, somebody that we would consider to be 6 through 12 in our class, we're going to be happy with it, and we might as well make that commitment now or take that commitment now.
Yeah, it's an intriguing, you know, piece of whether it's analytics or just thought and just trying to figure this thing out. And I always feel like, for me, especially in the back, I'm on the back nine right now, for sure, looking out, and that we're just always a little bit sluggish in recognizing that after the fact, and trying to figure it out for ourselves. Cause I don't think there is an exact science to this. There is not. There is not an exact science to this. You know, and certain programs have just more opportunity because they're more highly sought after by recruits across the country because they deem them the utopia of our sport right now, and others have to just kind of sit and wait. So I think each year I would say it's the same. It presents the exact same challenges. You know, you're just always trying to figure out when you're going to be number one on their list, and they're going to try to figure out when you're number one on that list. And it's a question of either, are you patient enough? Do you have good enough relationships to get to that point? And I would just say, yes, it's happening quicker now than it's ever, but I'll imagine it just comes right down to that. Once somebody finds that's our number one, we find that's our number one, whether it's in the 10, class of 10, or it's your best, they're making decisions, and maybe the process being sped up so much relative to past years, it's just created or yielding more of those commitments now.
Jeff Tamburoni, it's always a pleasure. Always a gift to be able to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Same. Thanks, Terry. Great catching up.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.